Two, one. What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the Chasing Clarity Health and Fitness Podcast. This is your host, Brandon DeCruz, and today is episode 93, where I had the pleasure and the honor of having one of my favorite experts in this field, Dr. Scott Stevenson. Don't worry, Scott, this is the last time I'm going to call you doctor throughout the course of the show, but I have Dr. Scott on the show with me to cover the topic of whether or not is there is an upper limit to protein-stimulated muscle anabolism. So in this podcast, Scott and I are going to dig deep into a recently released study by Tromlin and colleagues, which has been making the rounds within the evidence-based scene, within nutrition, within social media, and all these things. And then we're also going to cover a lot of the other evidence we have around protein intake, as the topic of protein is something that many within our audience are hugely interested in due to the fact that from a nutrition perspective, protein is the macronutrient we most need to prioritize to improve the results we get from a muscle growth, a body composition, a fat loss, and a metabolic perspective. And so the first study we're going to cover is entitled "The Anabolic Response to Protein Ingestion During Recovery from Exercise Has No Upper Limit in Magnitude and Duration in Vivo in Humans." And so, Scott and I were kind of discussing this off air, but the title of this study is interesting as it definitely drew a lot of attention. But as we'll get into it, I think that this has led many to they take like misextrapolations of this findings of this study and then how applicable it is. And this is why I wanted to have Scott on the podcast to really dig deep into this new study and then also go through the large body of evidence that we have on protein intake, anabolism, and muscle growth, which we also have to keep in mind because, Scott and I were just speaking about this, personally, but we have to keep in mind that evidence-based practice isn't about taking what the newest study on a topic finds and running with it. It's more so about taking on new information than seeing where this fits within the rest of the well-done literature that we have on a topic. So we can't just discard the foundation, everything else that we know within a topic because something new comes out. We need to fit and mold the new evidence to what previous evidence has substantiated. So really, when it comes down to it, there seems to be, I want to, kind of build this out in terms of the context of what we knew about protein or what many have believed, and then what this new study finds. So there seems to have been like this old thought process around protein intake, where many were under the impression that if you ingest more than, say, 20 to 25 grams of protein at a meal, it isn't useful, as there is some data that has suggested that protein synthesis is maximized at 20 to 25 grams per meal. But mind you, this is in college-age males using a high-quality, leucine-rich protein source such as whey isolate. And the rest, what they often will claim, they'll say that you can't absorb more than 20 to 25 grams of protein, or that the rest will essentially go to waste or will be oxidized or burnt. And a lot of people take this to mean that if they ingest more than 25 grams of protein in a sitting, it'll either not be absorbed, it won't contribute to a further increase in muscle protein synthesis, or it'll be converted to glucose. But this has been disproven by multiple well-controlled studies. But it seems like none of these studies have received as much press as this new study. So that's why we really want to go through it. So to start off, this deep dive off, Scott, I'd really love if you could take us through the study and inform the audience, like if we could start with, maybe the study design and what question the researchers were trying to answer within the context of conducting this study.
Yeah, I think the first thing that's important to recognize is a well-controlled study, a well-designed study is going to try to control for any extraneous variables, any other factors that are known to influence whatever the outcome measures are. So in this case, for instance, if we're talking about protein synthesis being something that's going to be influenced by the nutrient status of the individual, whether you're fed or not fed, they're going to pay attention to that. All the subject, they will either use that as a variable or they will make sure that their subjects are fasted or not fasted. And if they are do have a meal previous to when they start making their measurements, they will have controlled that. Well, in this case, first thing that's important to know is that they have taken fasting subjects here. So they haven't had anything. I think they stopped, made sure they didn't eat after about 10 or 11 the previous night, and they brought them in early to the lab. And the idea was to look, and they did a really nice job, to look at pretty much everything simultaneously that one could in terms of protein metabolism. I've never seen a study where they made all of these measures simultaneously. So it's really pretty cool.
This had to be an expensive study, to say the
Oh
least.
my gosh, I can't imagine how long it took actually to do all these analyses too. They were looking at whole body protein synthesis. What they did, they had a really crafty way of doing this. They used an isotopically labeled leucine and phenylalanine, and you can do this by feeding. In this case, they used milk proteins. That's important. So first step back is we're paying attention to what kind of proteins being ingested here by their subjects. There's an important feature that other studies have borne out, that the rate at which that protein enters the bloodstream seems to have an impact, has an impact, of course, on the level of amino acids, and the plasma level of amino acids is then going to impact the protein synthesis that you have. One of the ideas that comes from this study is that more protein did not mean more protein oxidation. That is something that other studies have found otherwise. They found that actually there is protein oxidation the more protein you take in. But they were studying in those cases a different kind of protein, whey protein. Here we have milk protein. So they fed these cows different amounts of these labeled isotope containing protein or protein sources. So then they could exactly know the molar percentage of these isotopes. So they could very control, this is really, really nice. It's very specifically control. They're feeding these isotopes into these individuals, or actually they're infusing them while they're taking in milk protein, and through a number, and I can't tell you, I'm definitely not an expert in this area, through a number of complicated calculations, and I actually attempted to look in this. I wish they'd given a little more background and citations to substantiate some of the information, because it doesn't seem to match with some of the other data that's out there. They basically wanted to look at what happens in terms of whole body protein synthesis, or whole body protein synthesis, whole body protein catabolism, and then from there, also whole body protein oxidation. When these individuals were basically ate nothing, were given 25 grams of milk protein or 100 grams of milk protein after a quote unquote whole body resistance exercise program. These were recreationally trained individuals. They had to be between more than one or less than three recreational activity bouts per week. So if someone, let's say they went to the gym and they played basketball four or five times a week, that would be too much.
They were excluded.
They were excluded. They were too recreationally trained. And these were not resistance trained individuals. So one thing worth noting there, so we've got a couple of things going on. They take non-resistance trained individuals, sort of, they're not sedentary, but they're not extremely active. And they're doing probably the first resistance training bout that they've done in a long time. We know that things are different in terms of what the protein synthetic response to that initial exercise bout is when someone starts a novel resistance training program versus what happens several weeks in when you get past that protective effect, that repeated bout effect. So these, for someone who's listening, think, what can I do with this information and apply it to me? Recognize that these are the guys who wander in probably during this week. We're here in the second week now of the year, who wander in for the very first time to the gym after the New Year's resolution, because they're going to get buffed like their favorite Instagram superstar or what have you, that don't know how to lift, that literally have to read the directions on the side of the purple machines at Planet Fitness, right? I'm not trying to make fun of anyone, but this is literally people who don't know their way around the weight room. So that's important to know. And they don't have those adaptations for resistance training. They go through their bout. They actually infuse them for, I think, an hour or two, 150 minutes, I believe, not terribly long. Just I'm adding that in because something, when looking at protein oxidation, and perhaps maybe an expert will chime in on this. I'd love to hear from someone who knows their way around this, how to, this literature and this methodology. I was trying to figure out in the last day or so to what extent you can really get a good handle on protein oxidation in a very, very short term. So anyway, they infused them, they ran them through their workout, and then they had them just sit still for the next 12 hours after they'd eaten nothing. So literally they were fasted when they came in, they got rigged up, they trained, and they sat there in one of the, in one group got Zippo. They basically ate nothing for the next 12 hours. The other group, 25 grams of casein, the other group, 100 grams of casein, or sorry, milk protein. I'm saying casein because it's 80% casein, 20%. Milk protein.
And the reason it's important to differentiate that, because we're going to see concentrations of amino acids in the peak plasma at much different intervals than we do with much of the literature that centers on whey protein isolate. And also within the whey protein isolate studies, we do see a higher rate of protein oxidation when we get to higher levels of protein intake from that whey isolate. So we really have to be very cognizant of the fact that this is a slower digesting protein. If you're familiar with casein, it is, from a protein product or a protein supplementation perspective, far slower than is whey isolate. And so what we're looking at is mostly because it's milk and we're looking at the nutritional composition of milk, it's 80% casein, more of a slower digesting protein, and only 20% whey protein. So even within that, when we actually look at the literature on protein intake and protein studies using a whey isolate, at 20 grams, we actually don't see high rates of oxidation. At 40 and above, we do. However, if we actually take it even in the context of the highest dose group, so we have a group that received post-workout 0 grams of milk protein. We have another one that received 25 grams of milk protein. And then we also had the high group, which received 100 grams. Well, if we just do the math on that, they only really received or ingested 20 grams of whey, from the constituent amino acids.
Right,
And so,
sure.
to not see protein oxidation increase, it could be logical, or it could even be in line with what the rest of the protein research shows, just not in the fact that we're taking a larger dose and trying to extrapolate the findings that we see within a whey to a milk protein, which we cannot do because we don't have dose response studies going this high on any protein source, let alone on a milk protein.
Yeah, the thing that if people are having trouble kind of following the difference between whey versus milk versus casein, this is kind of an analogy. It's a very rough one, but it's imagine what it's like to cook your steak with the burner very, very low, so the fire is coming in at a very, very slow rate. That's what's happening with casein or milk protein. So your amino acid entry into the bloodstream is very, very low. Casein forms a clot in the gut, and also some of the dye and tripeptides that are released there have bind the opioid receptors, so that actually slows motility in the gut. Just like if people take opioid-based painkillers, they tend to have constipation. So this is a slow protein. It was called, I think, it was Boree was the first study in like 97, and they made some measurements actually demonstrating oxidation rates versus for leucine versus casein. It's a slow dribble, so to speak, for that entire 12 hours. So that's very, very important. And you can't compare those things. If you take your steak and crank up your grill to max heat and throw it on there, you're going to have a different phenomenon than if you slow cook it at the proper amount of heat. You might end up burning the outside. Consider that, call that oxidation, so to speak, and you don't cook some of the inside. And you do that, like you have to take the steak off before it's all the way cooked because you burn the outside. So it's not a great analogy, but that for some people are just kind of grasping what's going on here with all this protein kinetic stuff. These guys are blasting with this information. It's super, super important because the way that steak tastes when it comes off the grill is going to be very different if you cooked it on full heat, threw it on there, or you throw a meat piece of meat on there, it's frozen, right? Even worse. And then it gets cooked very, very differently. So that's the thing that is not really made terribly clear, unfortunately, in their discussion. They just talk about protein. They don't discriminate between whey or milk or casein, and you just can't really do that. It's like saying, all cars are the same, and they're all cars are different than trucks, and you've got Pintos, you've got Lamborghinis. They're completely different animals. Whey is a completely different animal. It is a protein source, animal-based protein source. It has higher levels of leucine in it as well, slightly, than casein. So, and it has a totally different profile in terms of amino acid entry into the bloodstream. And that seems to make a difference. The theory and the understanding up to this point is that once you reach a point where you basically have amino acid entry, so that you maximize protein synthesis, so disposal in those pathways has been maximized, there's going to be some overflow somewhere, and that would go to oxidative pathways, which we see it in terms of phenylalanine oxidation and leucine oxidation when you get to 40 grams for sure, at least. So 30 or 40 grams. So they measured myofibrillar protein synthesis. That's actually important too. Some studies have just measured mixed muscle protein synthesis. There's also some interesting phenomena in the literature comparing those two things. They measured actually plasma protein synthesis, and they measured molecular signaling like mTOR, P70S6K, EF4B1, EF4, yeah, right? I mix up the acronym. Oh,
I
OB2.
was getting confused, to be honest.
Yeah. So we're looking at
These are all
basic
essentially an anabolic pathways. So if we think
anabolic
about
pathways.
mTOR, These are a pathway in order to stimulate anabolism. So generally, and what's really interesting, we'll get through this a little bit later. I do want us to first break down what were their results in terms of the anabolic effects and the MPS elevations from the different intakes of protein. So if we compared, obviously we're going to discard the 0 grams. That was a control condition. But if we just look at
It's nice to
25
have, though. That's
grams,
important, actually.
no, absolutely. But if we compare 25 grams to 100 grams and we extrapolate what their results were in terms of, we could look at mixed muscle protein synthesis. I think the most, interesting but also most applicable is myofibrillar protein synthesis, actually looking at the
Absolutely.
contractile elements. But then we can also look at plasma because they showed a differentiation and dose response between all three of those categories. So Scott, if you could expand upon those.
Basically, sort of universally, they found that the higher the protein dose, compared with 0, 25 was better than 0, and 100 was better than 25, a graded increase in protein synthesis, basically everywhere they measured it. Especially in terms of where we're really most interested is myofibrillar protein synthesis, but they also found it in terms of plasma protein synthesis, which really isn't all that important for us. One of the questions you asked in the outline you set, just to kind of run through this is interesting, is that they were actually, because they made so many measurements, they were actually able, I'm looking up the numbers here, they're actually able to quantify how many grams of protein from the dose, because the protein synthesis, a large part of the protein synthesis happening is because of endogenous proteins. So there's always some protein and breakdown occurring. Proteins are being reincorporated. They're moving from one place in the body to another. But the elevation in protein synthesis with the protein feedings came from that exogenous protein, as one would expect. And I think the number was something like 13 grams of protein, was incorporated into myofibrillar protein in that 100 gram of milk protein group. And then like 4 grams or so, a little bit less than 4 grams in the other group. So go ahead.
So in all time points, we're seeing that the 100 gram dose led to more anabolism, which is a load a lot of people are taking from the study, and it is a fact. So if we look just sequentially at things, we see a linear dose response in terms of whole body protein synthesis, where 100 grams of the milk protein led to greater elevations in both plasma amino acids as well as whole body mixed protein synthesis than 25 grams. Then when we go down a little bit layer deeper into myofibrillar protein synthesis, we see that myofibrillar protein synthesis rates were 20% higher during the early period, which was measured from 0 to 4 hours, but then 40% higher during the subsequent 4 to 12 hour period in the 100 gram protein dose as compared to the 25 gram protein dose. And that's important to realize, and the reason why we gave a caveat to the digestibility or the digestion rate of this protein, because the protein kinetics are going to leave plasma amino acids in the serum for a much longer period of time. It's almost like this trickle effect due to the slower gastric motility and entrance of these amino acids into the bloodstream. Then also, I mean, not that this is as applicable, but even from a plasma level, they saw that plasma protein synthesis rates were approximately 14% higher and 20% higher in the, following the ingestion of 100 grams as compared to 25 grams during the first 4 and 12 hour period. And then you are right when we're talking about the incorporation, which I found really interesting. This is why I had asked you that question, because if we actually look into the literature on this, what's really interesting is that when we look at studies looking at 20 grams, this quote that I've always heard is that only 10% of the ingested protein derived amino acids get incorporated into skeletal muscle tissue. So all the research that we really have on 20 gram doses of whey, we only see an incorporation of 2 grams into the actual skeletal muscle tissue during, and generally they're measuring this between 3 and 6 hours postprandially, meaning after the ingestion of those proteins. But in this study, they actually found 13%. So of that 100 gram dose over that 12 hour period, they actually had 13 grams incorporated, which is interesting to think about because that is a higher dose. So what a lot of people are going to extrapolate this out is that, and they even put this in their study, is that this data demonstrates that skeletal muscle tissue has a much greater capacity to incorporate exogenous amino acids than previously suggested. But then we have to go back to the caveat that these are new trainees. So the rate at which they can accrue muscle proteins is much higher than someone that's trained. Because Scott, you and I always talk about this on our own private calls, that if someone was gaining, say, 4 grams of, of muscle per day, or being able to incorporate 4 grams, that's like 12 or 13 pounds in a year of muscle that they're actually gaining. It's a very small portion. You've done all the math. You and I have went back and forth on this. It's like 7.4 grams per day to gain 25 pounds of muscle. So essentially, just so the audience knows, you would have to take in at the amount of protein. So say you get 200 grams of protein per day. If you were able to incorporate 7.4 grams of that per day for the entirety of the year, you would gain 25 pounds of muscle tissue. And a lot of people don't realize how little of the protein we ingest actually gets incorporated into muscle tissue because there are so many other endogenous processes, enzyme creation. We have a lot, about 50% of protein that we ingest goes to the gut and goes to different tissues and bodily organs. And that's why it's referred to as whole body protein synthesis because it's going to all these different organs, these tissues, enzymes. It creates hormones like insulin, peptides, things of that sort. There's so many things that protein is essential for, which is why they're, we have essential amino acids. But I found that aspect of it to be very fascinating, but also easy for people to misextrapolate because they may think more protein in a single dose means I'm going to gain more muscle, which is another hot take that I see a lot of people getting, but they're forgetting about all the context behind things like, yes, in a new trainee, their rate of muscle accretion, remember, they're so much further from their genetic ceiling that their ability to gain and actually build new contractile proteins is at a much more expedited or higher rate than someone that is trained. If we took well-trained individuals, 6 to 10 years of training, and then gave them the same 100-gram dose, I don't know if that same incorporation would be found, especially if we did a longitudinal study, which we did this over the course of 12 weeks.
This is the interesting. We have to contextualize all this. This was an accumulation of protein in the myofibrillar component. So this is basically calculated from all of the extraordinary measurements they made and their myofibrillar protein synthesis rate. So I gathered together some numbers, some variety of studies, and some of them used mixed muscle protein synthesis. Some of them use which is not comparable. It's not the same as myofibrillar. That's a different component. A mixed muscle is just kind of everything. You can extract out sarcoplasmic, you can extract out mitochondrial, and each of those will give you different answers in terms of a percent increase in protein synthesis per hour. But if we look at, for instance, a study from Atherton, there was no exercise, and they gave a 48-gram dose of whey. Their percent increase per hour on a per hour rate peaked at 0.10. That's the highest number I think I found anywhere. That was at like, I think 180 minutes, something like that, or the time frame between maybe 60 and 180 minutes. So within the first 2 or 3 hours with a whey protein. In this particular study with 100 grams, the myofibrillar protein synthesis was less than half that numerically, 0.047. We see numbers with 40 grams of whey protein being 0.059, so 0.06. So there's no statistics there, but potentially higher. There's another study from Wittard, which we may talk about, 40 grams there, 0.079. So we're comparing again 0.047 for 100 grams of casein over 12 hours with a peak of 0.079, or an average over 4 hours of 0.079, so substantially more, but over a shorter time frame. So what we're talking about here is a totally different temporal pattern of elevation of protein synthesis. So if we go back, I want to sort of contextualize this even more. If we go back to the title, and I can't remember exactly how it reads, but basically there's no limit. Maybe you got it there in front of
Yeah,
you.
let me pull up. I had this study in front of me before. So the title
Yeah.
is "The Anabolic Response to Protein Ingestion During Recovery from Exercise Has No Upper Limit in Magnitude and Duration in Vivo in Humans." And Scott, I'm going
That
to let
was
you
it.
take this over. Explain why that's a little bit of a catch-baity title, and also a little bit misleading. And it could lead a lot of people, which a lot of people on social media, they're taking this to mean something that it isn't. So if you could just extrapolate out and really expand upon why we can't infer that from the results of these findings.
Yeah, that's why I want to make sure I didn't misquote the title, because it said no upper limit in magnitude. And we have other studies in the literature demonstrating higher magnitudes of protein synthesis. So we haven't exceeded the maximal reported rate of protein synthesis, myofibrillar protein synthesis in this study. So you can't really say that we've got a no upper limit in magnitude. If you want to say that you've got a car that has no mag, it can run at the speed of light, but it runs at a quarter of the speed of light, and there's many other vehicles that run at a half speed of light, you can't say it's the fastest car ever, and that it can go faster than any other car whatsoever. It is limited, and we haven't demonstrated that. One thing you noted accurately earlier is that there was sort of a linear relationship between the 25 gram and the 100 gram doses in terms of protein synthesis. You see this basically throughout the study. That is indeed linear, without a doubt, because you've only got 2 points. You're gonna make a line that way. It's difficult to create a dose response there. We have a zero, that's nice, right? And it's pretty much zero, it's linear through there, but we can't create a very accurate dose response when there's potential for, let's say, a 50. And not that I was like, I could just go this and whip this up in my garage or in my kitchen sink. It's a massive amount of work that went into this.
Oh, absolutely.
But to make that claim, and they, part of the rationale for choosing the 100 gram dose is that that is something that typically individuals would consume in a large meal.
No, absolutely. We do see a skewed pattern. So if you actually look at the American pattern of eating, it's very low protein doses in the morning, a little bit greater at lunch. And we eat our biggest bolus in the Western populations in the evening. So generally 65 to 75 grams of protein, what we see on population-based averages. But then when I really think about it from the context of our demographic, which are people that are interested in fitness and in nutrition, as well as body composition improvement, we really can't say that they found the upper limit, because to truly test the upper limit of protein, we would have to go to what the average person that trains is eating. And I'll tell you personally, and I know this to be the fact about yourself, many of my clients and myself are eating much more than 100 grams of protein per day. So we're not really seeing the upper limit. We're seeing the highest dose that's been tested in the literature to date. And I think that's a little bit better and more of a intellectually honest way to depict this, because that is, they did test the highest dose that we've ever tested in literature, but 100 grams over 12 hours, many people are going to eat far more than that in the course of a 12-hour eating window.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw this paper, but they actually published another paper, Tromelin et al. Published another paper in 2023, where they compared whey and casein over a 7-hour window after endurance exercise.
Is this the mitochondrial protein one?
They did that, yes, but if you look in that paper, they also have myofibrillar data too.
Okay,
that's the one. You're right, and their whey protein values were 0.064. So we're talking about 0.47 in the 100 gram milk protein, and for whey 0.64, and casein 0.056. That's over a 7-hour window. So they themselves have published something in the same calendar year showing a higher value. In their own lab. So the same methodology, same people doing the same thing. So it's a bit of an odd claim to make that there is no limit in magnitude. They also claim no limit in duration. What we have here, I think this is what's going on. If we imagine, like, one thing you wanted to talk about was this idea of a muscle full effect. That's an effect that seems to be abolished by training, but in the untrained state, and this is when this Atherton study that I mentioned before, if you take a larger dose, I think they use like 48 grams of protein, in this case of whey protein, you'll see an elevation of muscle protein synthesis that will then drop off despite persisting elevation of blood amino acid levels. And that's a protein stat mechanism. Milward mentioned this, you know, decades ago in like the 90s, that makes sense that we don't just have runaway protein synthesis. Right. And all the organs are just growing like crazy in some sort of cancer like fashion. But you increase the sensitivity to exogenous amino acids through training. So you can overcome that protein stat or that muscle full effect. You see that with whey protein, where you get this massive elevation of much greater elevation of both blood amino acids and protein synthesis. In this case, We're piddling along at a much smaller, like the 0 gram in this particular study, the Tromelin study, the one we're focusing on here, their 0 gram myofibrillar protein synthesis was 0.029. So basically 0.03. And they went to 0.047 with 100 grams. So they increased by about 50, a little less than 50% protein synthesis rates with the milk protein over these 12 hours. So they weren't revving the protein synthesis engine at some crazy rate. That's sort of the idea behind this muscle full effect, at least in the untrained state, or if you haven't trained recently, is that you ramp up protein synthesis and then the muscle would become full. And then it doesn't make any sense to continue protein synthesis. That can be overcome actually with carbohydrate too, if you provide some energy. You need energy, obviously, for the protein synthetic machinery to keep functioning. But in this case, when you're talking about no limit in terms of duration, this is sort of like saying the gas tank for protein synthesis just can go forever. You
Yeah,
know,
and I also,
it's yeah, go
I
ahead,
think
please.
the other issue that a lot of people, and I'm seeing like people misextrapolate this, is we have to realize that initial increases in muscle protein synthesis do not automatically lead to muscle growth. Like we need a longitudinal study to test this,
Mentioned
not a
before,
12-hour study.
yes.
And so just because we saw, and you're even extrapolating out, you're running numbers that a lot of people in the audience aren't going to be able to follow. Essentially, what Scott's trying to get to is the increase in muscle protein synthesis that we saw in this very large protein dose study, even at the maximal dose of 100 grams, is still less than we see in other dose response studies over 3 to 6 hours utilizing smaller
Moderate.
doses of protein. And then we also have research that looks at multiple doses. So I think that what this study is really good to do is that it blatantly disproves or is able to really shed light on the fact that, the cap to protein intake at a meal is not 20 grams, which many people are under the impression
Oh,
about. And this is something
right.
I do want to, I'm going to cover this next. So this really like blows it out of the water. So now people realize, hey, we could absorb more than 20 grams of protein. We always could absorb as much grams, essentially from an
We've done
absorption and
that
digestion
for
perspective.
decades and decades. Yeah.
Yeah, we both understand this, but a lot of people think that there's a rate limiter in terms of digestion. You could essentially absorb as much protein as you take in. Is that going to go right to muscle protein synthesis? No. There's going to be oxidation because it's essentially going to be used as a fuel substrate at some point when amino acids, get so peaked so heavily in the blood that you're essentially taking in that protein as energy because you take in 200 grams of protein in one singular sitting. It's like you're not going to put those 800 calories to use just for protein synthesis and just for the incorporation of amino acids into skeletal
If
muscle. Like
only,
that's
if
a
only,
large
that would be
meal,
great.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We wish, but I want to walk this back a little bit and go through some of the data previously and what led people to believe certain things that they have, some of these myths, some of these misconceptions, and then we can get, we can dig in deeper into some of the other research that actually is in line with this, because a lot of people think that this 100 gram dose is like the first time that we've seen a larger dose than 20 to 25 grams actually increase muscle protein synthesis more, which isn't the case whatsoever. So first, I want to go through, the claim of there being a cap to 20 grams of protein per meal to maximize anabolism and where that comes from. And this thought process comes from a study that was conducted by Moore and colleagues in 2009. And essentially, in the study, they took young men and gave them graded doses of egg protein post-workout. And they had multiple groups. So they had one group that received 0 grams, one group that received 5 grams, 10 grams, 20 grams, and then 40 grams of egg protein. And the study found that the biggest increase in muscle protein synthesis were seen when growing, like the biggest significant difference was going from the 10 grams of protein post-workout to 20 grams of protein post-workout. But, and Scott, you and I both know this because we've discussed this. If you actually look at the graphs, the 40 gram dose still elicited a larger MPS response, but this was not statistically significant. So this led authors to conclude, and I'm actually going to pull up the paper right now so I get the correct verbiage of this. So their conclusion was the ingestion of 20 grams of intact protein is sufficient to maximally stimulate muscle protein synthesis. So it's not that it's the highest elevation. 40 grams just wasn't statistically significant. I want to say it was like a 7 or 8% difference. However, there's other studies. If we look, this was a 2009 study. If we go even, more recent studies, there are other studies since that time that have reported different findings and have found that elevations in muscle protein synthesis levels are maximized at higher doses than 20 grams in a sitting. So I believe the first study to show this was done by McNaughton et al. And colleagues in 2016. And in this study, they took resistance trained males who had lower levels of lean mass and then also those who had higher levels of lean body mass and put them through a whole body resistance training session, after which they had them consume either 20 grams or 40 grams of whey protein. And this study found that 40 grams of protein after a training session stimulates a greater MPS response than 20 grams, regardless of the participant's level of lean body mass. Then we also have two other studies that come out of Dr. Robert Wolf's lab that has found that doses above 20 grams of a quality protein source maximize the anabolic effect we get from eating protein. So I want to go through these because I want people to realize this is not an odd finding to show that above a 20 to 25 gram dose does stimulate muscle anabolism more than a 20 gram dose. There is not that cap from a digestion perspective or from a muscle protein synthesis perspective. So the first study on this subject to come out of Robert Wolf's lab was done in 2016, and they looked at the rates of whole body nitrogen balance to see the difference between MPS and muscle protein breakdown, or MPB, at rest and after exercise when given different doses of protein. And in this
And
study,
this
they
is
took.
mixed muscle too. It's important to kind of point that out because people just throw it all together and it's not quite the same. But
Absolutely.
keep going. I just wanted to make sure
So,
that people are aware of that.
no, 100%. I appreciate that. And so, in this study, they took young, healthy adults who were resistance trained. So they had a training background, and they gave them either 40 grams of protein or 70 grams of protein. And they found that both doses resulted in positive protein balance. However, net protein balance was greater in response to the meal containing 70 grams of protein versus 40 grams of protein. So what they postulated was that this greater net balance was achieved primarily through a greater reduction in muscle protein breakdown and, to a lesser extent, stimulation of protein synthesis. The 70 gram dose also resulted in greater
They will show
plasma essential amino acid responses versus 40 grams, with no differences in insulin or in glucose responses between doses. So this study found that net protein balance improves with greater protein intake above that what was previously suggested to maximally stimulate muscle protein synthesis because of that simultaneous reduction in protein breakdown. Then what they did within this lab, which I love when they do these very controlled studies that are also, they mimic in different populations. So this was in young, healthy adults that were resistance trained, but then in 2020, they repeated the same exact study
Let me
design.
just throw one interesting thing in there because this is
Absolutely.
fascinating. Because they actually, what you just said about positive protein balance in the whole body, absolutely sure, certain it was because of a reduction in the higher protein intake group in protein balance. But when you looked at the mixed muscle protein synthesis at the muscle level, there was a little bit of an increase, but I don't believe it was significant. It was very high. But there was no difference between those two. They didn't have a zero. They didn't have a
Yes.
nothing. It would have been interesting.
It would
So
have been even
there's
interesting, more
sometimes,
interesting if they put a 20, a 40, and a 70 gram dose.
yeah, or at least a 20, right? That would have been great. That would have been perfect. And I bring that up, not to throw off your groove here with going through these studies, but that sometimes we see kind of this a discordance with whole body protein synthesis measurements and myofibrillar protein synthesis. In the Tromlin study we're focused on today, everything sort of resonated really well. But this Park study, I think you're going to get into now, out of the same lab, showed something different, actually. So it's interesting, like these measurements, the vibe that I get, the feel that I get. For instance, there's a older study from Bird where they found that there was no effect after a training bout of increased protein on mixed muscle protein synthesis, but there was on myofibrillar. So myofibrillar is more sensitive, as you might expect. That's the protein that accumulates when muscles get bigger, when they hypertrophy. That component of the muscle protein synthesis is more sensitive to your protein intake or larger protein intakes after you've trained. But then some of these studies, they just measure mixed protein synthesis, and the one I think you're going to mention does show an effect there.
Absolutely.
On mixed muscle, whereas once it's like, we should ignore the mixed muscle from now on, but people still keep on measuring and still keep seeing a graded effect too, which is what the MORP study actually, the first one you just mentioned, with this graded effect from 0 up to 20 and then maybe nothing after 40. So my point there is that if you look at the studies as a whole, and I kind of dissected some of this out and to get ready for today, it's interesting that you see studies disagreeing with one another. And that's important to keep in context with this Tromlin study, because some of the things in the study disagrees with things in other studies, which is what you're talking about now. This Kim study and this Park et al. Study from Wolf's lab, some things in that study don't quite match up with the Tromlin study. So, all right, back on track with the Wolf study, Park et al. From 2020. It's
Yes,
very
sir.
similar
No,
follow-up Kim et al. Study.
a very similar design, but I really like this because it was in healthy older adults. And we know that there is something, a phenomenon called anabolic resistance, where those that are an older demographic, they lose sensitivity to anabolic stimuli, and that includes amino acids. So that means they would need a higher dose of protein to get the same protein synthetic response to a meal, but also to resistance training. And that's also why we see a greater prevalence of sarcopenia, of muscle loss, muscle wasting, and things of that sort. So where essentially within the study, what they did was they examined the anabolic response to a mixed meal containing either 35 grams of protein or 70 grams of protein in a randomized crossover metabolic ward study, so highly controlled. And the results of this study were consistent with their previous findings in young, healthy adults. However, they found that positive net balance was achieved due mainly to the suppression of protein breakdown in both the 35 gram condition and to a greater extent in the 70 gram condition, while protein synthesis was only increased in the 70 gram group. So All three of these studies that I just went through reinforced what the Tromlin paper found in terms of protein doses higher than 20 to 25 grams, which a lot of people consider the cap, being able to further stimulate muscle protein synthesis. But I also think it's important to not take this data to mean that you can just eat all your protein in one meal and maximize your ability to stimulate and
Right.
accrue muscle tissue, because we have to realize protein isn't stored like other nutrients, which is why we need more frequent protein feedings, not only on a daily basis, but throughout the course of a week to maximize muscle anabolism. Whereas on the other hand, we do store carbohydrates long term in glycogen, as well as especially fats in adipose tissue, where we
Problem
can tap
there.
into them and use them for later. So this brings us on to our next topic, which Scott, I really want you to dive into, and then I'll recap it as well. But
Before we jump to that, I want to make highlight something you just said. So those two studies, the Park et al. Study, the two studies out of Wolf's lab, those both showed with those higher protein feedings, actually both in both cases, that the increase in protein balance was mainly attributed to a reduction in protein
protein breakdown,
breakdown. That's not what we find in the Tromlin study.
which is
They didn't
interesting.
find
But you
they,
know
yeah,
what?
it
I
was.
actually I could not find muscle protein breakdown readings or ratings on that. So where did they actually measure muscle protein breakdown
They have a
in the
formula for
Tromlin?
it. Yeah.
Did they? I didn't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's in the back at the very end with all the methods they got. I was looking through trying to
Because I
decipher
was
all of them.
imagining, because I when you know, and I don't want us to go off on this
There's
tangent
a
because
graph actually too.
Scott, you and I will go down this like deep water hole that no one will follow. But I just want to say, if we think about the Demosec, which showed that MPS elevations in muscle protein synthesis do not correlate to muscle growth until we get past the initial phase of a training, where then we see muscle protein synthesis levels actually decline a little bit. So initially, during a protein or
Sure.
during a training session or a training program, we see greater elevation in muscle protein synthesis, but we also see such great increases in muscle protein breakdown due to the novelty of that new resistance training stimulus that really all that muscle protein synthesis is doing is those resources are just being allocated towards recovering muscle damage. Whereas when we get later into that DeMoss study, which is a 12-week study, I believe, and it's looking at longitudinal hypertrophy, then once muscle protein breakdown comes a little bit down because of the repeated bound effect that has that protective mechanism where we don't see as much muscle damage being incurred from the same bouts of resistance training, we actually see muscle protein synthesis levels go down a little bit more, but now they're actually gaining muscle tissue. So that's why I was wondering about the Tromlin study, because we could have seen these massive elevations in protein synthesis, which aren't really that massive as compared to the rest of the literature, but a lot of people are taking them to be these massive elevations of protein synthesis. And it could be because this is a novel training stimulus. So they have high rates of muscle protein breakdown, which is being compensated for by a compensatory increase in muscle protein synthesis.
That's the thing. They're billing this as this massive elevation of protein synthesis, where it really wasn't. You don't get that when you have the slow release that comes from a milk protein that's predominantly casein based. And I think, as I mentioned before, but it's worth bearing again, these subjects are not representative of someone who's been training for weeks and weeks. Just in that DAMA study, it's only after those first 3 weeks. And the presumption that we have, it was, I think it was Stu Phillips' work in the 90s showing increase. It's very difficult to measure muscle protein breakdown directly. You can measure whole body protein breakdown, but that's the interesting thing about this study, is that you would presume from everything we know from the rest of the body literature, that especially in the DAMA study, this is sort of the, when you look at the stats, you draw from the stats because there was no correlation between protein synthesis and the initial bout and the eventual growth that happened 12 weeks later. But the correlation was strong, like 3 weeks in at the very end of the program. It suggests, okay, there's something about the total, the muscle protein balance, such that probably muscle protein breakdown is skewing the relation that would be there. Some high variability people got so much breakdown, it's probably such a highly variable thing, or the breakdown is balancing out the protein synthesis, so that you don't have this relationship that's causal. We believe it to be causal, obviously. The more you can turn on synthesis over the course of time, the more muscle you accrue, the more hypertrophy you get. But that basically that relationship is askew. So probably it's because of muscle protein breakdown, which we're seeing because of the muscle damage, the injury, et cetera, that happens. In this particular, in the Tromlin study, they're not measuring muscle protein breakdowns. Like the only thing they didn't measure, like no one ever measures that. Everyone just
Yeah, so
cites back
I
to the Phillips study.
when you alluded to a formula, that's why I said I didn't directly see it studied, actually investigated the actual muscle protein breakdown rate. So it
I'll
wasn't
look.
like there was a
It's in one of the
suppression of it, you
plots.
know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's just the same. It doesn't change. It didn't change. It wasn't. There's no change for any of the groups. It's a whole body breakdown.
Yeah, and
That was the
that's
issue.
interesting, to
It
say the
is
least.
because it tells me that this whole body protein breakdown measurement they have is not sensitive to what's going on in the muscle
Especially
somehow.
because the control group getting 0 grams of protein that has no elevation of muscle protein synthesis or any decrease. Because think about like what happens when we ingest protein. We have an increase in plasma amino acids. We also have an increase in insulin. You know, milk proteins are insulinogenic, so that's going to have an effect on muscle protein degradation, where it's going to lower muscle protein breakdown. So even if the control group who went through a fasted state exercise went through I don't want to say a traumatizing bout of exercise, but it was full body training. They were training pretty hard. It was four movements, four sets each, decent volume, and they didn't even see a very
Failure.
large increase in, you know, a muscle protein breakdown. That's a little bit curious, as you know, compared to the other studies that we have on this topic.
Yeah, I'm gonna see if I can find the plot here because it's basically there's nothing to see. It wouldn't have jumped out at you. It's one of those. Sorry, my computer's being a little slow here. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, good. Good. I'm getting the spinning kaleidoscope when I'm trying to look through the study. But it is really fascinating. They're not even in this starvation condition where they go in fasted, they hit it hard, and then they eat nothing. Did you see any increase in muscle protein breakdown? And I imagine some of these guys are probably even getting their, if they measured inflammatory markers, I imagine they probably would have started feeling sore by the end of that day. They're probably just sitting there
We see
getting
muscle
up. Their
damage
leg.
generally sits in about 6 hours.
Yeah, they're starting to feel this. Let me see if I can find the plot here for, oh God, that's so small. I have to plug my computer in so I can use my big
No
screen.
worries, Scott. Scott, what I do
Anyway,
want to
it's
go
there.
through,
Yes.
and this is something I know that you're very well versed in, is I've seen a lot of like somewhat hot takes on Instagram and on social media regarding this study, and a lot of people are kind of using this as evidence against the benefit and the data on protein distribution and protein pacing, and kind of making it sound like you could just eat all your protein in one, you know, particular time of the day, and it'll last 12 hours because we saw an elevation in muscle protein synthesis. And I'd really love it if you could go through your thoughts on the benefits of spreading out our total daily protein intake across the day instead of getting it in just one single meal. And then, you know, I'll tie in a few of the studies that I'm familiar with that reinforce the benefit of doing so, because there's a difference between I'm going to go through mechanistic studies, but then I'll also go through longitudinal studies on this. But I would also love your opinion on the concept of protein distribution. And another thing that I know you're very well versed is the concept of protein pacing.
This is protein distribution. This is
No, absolutely.
yeah, this is interesting. This is perfectly distributed protein. It's 100 grams. The thing that this, I mean, let's we'll even kind of take a step back and look at what the external validity of this study is. And I feel like I'm being overly critical, but let's kind of give this the real world test here. So what the study suggests that you can take in 100 grams of protein every 12 hours. At least for those first 12 hours, if there's no limit, so to speak, the way they're sort of this has sort of been built, and they said it. I didn't choose the title; they did. So I'm just sort of taking it and running with it. Is that you could do basically a protein sparing modified fast, 200 grams of protein, 100 grams every 12 hours, and consistently and persistently elevate protein synthesis for the entire time, for the entire day, and just do a PSMF and train and. This isn't going to happen. This is what we have to consider this. If you took this acute study and tried to extend these findings over longitudinally over weeks, that you would then gain, let's go back to the numbers, 13 grams of protein in the myofibrillar component. So 26 grams of protein. That works out to that's going to be, I don't know
That's about 100
what's
grams of pro. That's about
that's going to be
roughly
like 100 pounds of
96 to
muscle a
100
year.
pounds of muscle in a
Yeah.
year. So what Scott's trying to get to is that this is literally feasibly impossible, and that's why we can't just look at
Yes.
mechanisms. I do like going through mechanisms so we know the underlying physiology behind something. But let's look at it like this, Scott. If we took this study and say that it was a 100 gram dose of protein every 12 hours, that's roughly 400 to 500 calories, depending on the composition of that protein source. With the, you know, maybe a little bit
Maybe
more
there's some
fat
fat
because
in
it's
there
a milk
later.
protein, things of that sort. However, we know from the protein synthesis data, both in terms of actual longitudinal studies and mechanistic studies, that being in a Areta et al. Did a 33% calorie deficit for 5 days. It lowered muscle protein synthesis rates by 27%, being in that degree of a deficit. We have other studies that show decreases in muscle protein synthesis when being in a 20% deficit of 19%. in muscle protein synthesis. So we're not going to have maximal protein stimulation if you're in a massive deficit.
No.
So this is
And you
where we can't
also,
extrapolate this out to the real world, unfortunately.
yeah. And if you look at, and this isn't a starvation study, but if you look at starvation studies and they use things like urea loss, nitrogen loss, you do see an elevation in nitrogen loss after the first day or so. And then things will kind of catch up when people start to adapt to the fact that they're
Especially if
starving.
someone's lean and healthy, like these individuals were. So they actually were healthy individuals. And we actually see there's a study in 1999 by Elia, and they look at the composition or the essentially the endogenous body stores that get broken down in a state of starvation or very low calorie diets. And they see that lean lose protein, degrade protein essentially, the oxidized protein at 2 to 3 times a greater fold than obese subjects. So if you're lean and then you're trying this protein sparing modified fast and you're trying to do 100 grams of protein here and there, a few times a day, and just thinking that you're going to maximize anabolism and then get the maximum fat loss benefits, most likely not.
The other thing too, we're getting away from the study a little bit, but we've talked about this in private conversation, is there is an extraordinary energy cost to building muscle. Right. When you try to, we went to this, we deep dove into this not too long ago. And the idea that one, you're going to have protein synthesis that's going to be maintained at this extraordinary rate without taking energy to do so. So it's interesting that this happened. You can have the situation where people will recomp, they'll drop body fat. So they're
Absolutely.
driving the energy for protein synthesis and muscle growth, hypertrophy from their endogenous body fat stores. That's cool. That can happen. But the idea that this would continue for this long without any protein coming in or out any other energy energy coming in is highly dubious in my mind.
And this would be such a massive deficit if we think about it. So the best recomp study that we have is out of Stu Phillips' lab. It's by Longlet et al., 2016. And what they did was they took previously trained individuals that had been detrained, and they put them through a 4-week study. And this actually used a 4-compartment model of body composition assessment. So we had DEXA, we had BIA, we had MRI, all these things. And they did a 4-compartment model for that. And they found that they lost approximately 10 pounds of body fat or 10 pounds of fat mass and gained 3 pounds of lean mass within that 4-week study. I mean, but they were also training 6 days a week, utilizing both HIIT training, hitting 10 to 12,000 steps per day. So high activity, high flux level. And they were at a 40% calorie deficit. But the group that actually recomped was at 2.4 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. Whereas the 1.2 group, they did an oscillating protein dose. So they had a lower protein dose with higher carbohydrates and a higher protein dose with lower carbohydrates. And in the 1.2, they just maintained their muscle and just lost fat. So yes, they technically recomp because their lean mass to fat mass ratio changed. But the more significant recomp was in a very high protein diet, but it still had sufficient carbohydrates and it was actually a very low fat diet. And so it wasn't like, if you were to take someone that has a 3,000 calorie maintenance, and you took them and you put them on this protein dose that's 400 grams or 400 calories from protein in the morning and maybe 400 calories at night, that's an 800 calorie diet. So the discrepancy in the in terms of they're essentially in a 75% calorie deficit or more, you know what I mean? It would be exorbitant.
It's a protein sparing modified fast, essentially. It's what this would be. And that's just not going to work. So back to the protein pacing idea. That's Arciero, and I think you have some studies you want to talk about. And the one thing that's sort of unfortunate about those studies, he's done a nice job of having people take like 20 to 40 grams in 5 to 6 times a day. So they end up with a pretty high protein intake. When you compare sort of being really diligent with your protein and pacing it or spacing it throughout the day, they have this sort of holistic training program where they do stretching, some weight training, some endurance training, et cetera, et cetera. And you get better fat loss that way. You get preferential visceral fat loss that way. You get performance enhancements compared to the group that takes in. There's all the same training, but just takes in less protein, like a gram per kilogram, I think is what usually they've done. So compare 2 versus 1 gram. 1 gram per kilogram, we kind of know that's not quite enough. So if you're going to go to 2, spread it out is basically what their data suggests. Then there's the other studies that you mentioned in our outline that you might want to go with, where you compare like skewed protein intake, basically undoing what you mentioned before, this typical American diet where everything's skewed toward the end of the day, and just balance that out. And having a bigger breakfast makes sense in the short term in terms of protein synthesis that you see over like a week's measurement, or in the long term when you're doing training, you just get better increases in lean body mass if you make sure that that protein is available. So I don't want to steal your thunder on that, but the one thing, let's come up, I want to say something positive because I feel like I've kind of been negative about the study so much, kicking into it, is this hasn't been studied directly, but if we do combine some logic with the idea that we have in milk protein a nice protein to feed amino acids in persistently after a long period. It's not the same when you have protein like whey in a meal with some fat in it, perhaps that's slowing the entry, but at least you know, let's say worst case scenario, it's like, man, I'm going to get up today. I have one day, I'm going to rent a U-Haul and I have one day to, or I got a buddy's truck and you can only have it for a day, right? And I'm not going to have time. I'm not even have time to jam a hamburger down my mouth, but I'm going to wake up and I'm going to at least going to have a, I'm going to slam a 100-gram milk protein shake. That's better than nothing. I think we could say that, you know?
And I think that is a great way to look at it. Or in the opposite fashion, we do have some late night, like casein study, protein studies, which show that it elevates muscle protein synthesis levels overnight. And now, when protein is
Sure.
equated, so whether they put that casein shake, there's a study by Joy et al., where they put the casein shake either in the morning that added to their protein dose, or they did it at night. So protein was equated, there was equivalent hypertrophy outcomes. But if you're that person that you're missing a protein dose, and it's something you can easily add in before you go to bed, an hour or two before bed, and you take down a casein shake, or it doesn't even have to be a casein shake. It could be a whole food, mixed meal that's going to have a, longer, protein kinetics in terms of its digestion rate. We see beef protein, it's 6, 7 hours it takes to digest. So you can literally take a whole food protein source and utilize that and have a trickle effect of amino acids in the serum throughout the night and keep muscle protein synthesis levels elevated during your longest bout. But I've seen a lot of people take this, and this is really why I wanted to educate on this, is that I don't want people to take this to believe that you only need protein at one time per day. And there are benefits from looking at, the timing and distribution of our protein intakes, because we have a large body of literature that shows the opposite. So, I'll go through some studies on this. Like, for example, the first study I think of when I think about protein distribution is a mechanistic study, because people are looking at mechanisms here. So let's look at mechanisms. So that's by Areta et al. In 2013. And they took well-trained lifters and had them go through three different conditions where they took muscle biopsies after each condition. And in each condition, they ate the same total daily protein intake over a 12-hour period. Now, in one condition, they split their total protein up intake into two large feedings that were 6 hours apart. In the next condition, they had them split their total daily protein intake in four even feedings that were eaten approximately every 3 hours. So each dose was approximately 25% of their total daily protein intake. And then in the last condition, they did like this pulsing mentality. And so what they did was, this is like the old bodybuilder mentality, where they divided their total protein intake up into eight smaller yet even feedings where they ate every 1.5 hours. Well, the results found that at every single time point, the myofibrillar protein synthesis levels, which is the direct protein synthesis involved in muscle gain, those rates were higher with the 25% even group who ate four even protein feedings per day and were superior to the large dose taken in two times per day and the smaller doses taken in eight times per day, despite protein intake being the same. So yes, protein intake is the hierarchy. If we look at a hierarchy of importance, your total daily protein intake is number one. But we can look at other little more nuanced aspects such as nutrient timing and distribution as, 1A and 1B essentially. And so in the next study, we have a study on meal
I think
consistency.
just so folks know, I want to throw this out. Like in the eight protein feedings, I think it was 8 times 10 grams. So little
It
itty
was a low
bitty
dose.
protein, or it was 4 times 20 grams, which is kind of this magical number. I think that's why they included it. Or then it was twice times 60 grams. No, 40. Was it twice times 60 or
Two
40
times
grams?
40 grams.
2 times 40 grams. So some middle ground makes sense. That 20 gram in this particular set, that 20 gram was a good dosing, but we can talk a little bit about leucine threshold. 10 grams isn't very much, right? What happens to that? I'd be interested to see, like using the technology from this trauma study, what happens to that 10 grams? Because protein's being oxidized, does it just sort of go into the general, we have so much endogenous protein amino acids in our pool. Does it that it, you don't get a bump enough to turn on protein? Apparently not. That's what this shows. And then with the 2 times 40 grams, it's still 80 grams over this period, right? It's up and down, so you have too many gaps in between where you're not stimulating protein. So there's a happy place, but I thought the numbers would be important because, like, who's going to have a 10 gram protein? That's like a little, it's like a creatine scoop for protein, like
Scott,
once.
we say that, but the average American eats about 6 to 10 grams of protein at breakfast. So, I mean, if we look at like Western populations, I mean, it is realistic for some people. And if they could just bump that up, a little bit, I can't tell you how many times I have a consultation with a new client and they tell me to have, they eat protein at breakfast, they have one egg. and a bunch of toast or cereal. And it's like they might have gotten 10 grams of that total. It's like one egg is
Right.
their threshold. So it is important to just educate on the fact that we're not talking about taking in massive doses of protein every single meal or becoming a bodybuilder, but there is a benefit. So a more even distribution. I think if we actually go through a study that's more comparable or more applicable in the real world, there's a Mamoreux study. And what they did was they conducted a study to compare the rates of muscle protein synthesis in those using an even protein distribution compared to an uneven distribution. And in this study, what they actually did was they looked at an even distribution of 3 meals of 30 grams of protein per meal versus a skewed Western eating pattern where they had the same total daily protein intake, but they had 10 grams at breakfast. So just like you alluded to, they had 15 grams at lunch, and then they had 65 grams at dinner, which is actually really does mimic what the average American is eating. And so they took muscle
Right.
biopsies and they saw that the even distribution group had a 25% greater rate of muscle protein synthesis over 24 hours than the uneven group, which suggests that we can make up for a suboptimal protein intake that was consumed early in the day by simply consuming more at night. Now, the best study that we have on this, honestly, and this is where, we can look at mechanisms. We just looked at different comparisons, but we do have one longitudinal study on this, and there's only one that's been done. It's by Yasuda and colleagues. And this was done in 2020. And they looked at an even versus skewed distribution protein intake pattern on young men engaged in progressive resistance training programs. And so this study looked at two groups resistance training for 12 weeks using different protein spacing approaches to see how it impact their body composition outcomes in terms of their gain in lean mass and their performance. And the even distribution group ate an average of 1.3 grams per kilogram per day, but split that over evenly over 3 meals. And so it was a little over 0.4 grams per kilogram per meal. Whereas the uneven distribution group averaged actually more protein. So they actually took in 1.45 grams per kilogram per day, but they did so in a skewed manner where they had a very low protein breakfast, a moderate protein lunch, and a very high protein dinner. Now, it's important to note that both groups weren't at the threshold that we'd consider or advise to be optimal, which would be between, based on the Morton meta-analysis, 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram to maximize muscle hypertrophy. But even so, the results found that both groups gained lean mass. However, the even distribution group gained 0.7 kilograms more, so about a pound and a half more, having gained 2.5 kilograms or 5.5 pounds of muscle by the end of that 12-week study. And they also saw better performance in the resistance training outcomes despite eating less protein. So if it was only about protein intake and protein dose in total and distribution didn't matter, we probably wouldn't see that. And then if we actually look at a great meta-analysis, it's a friend of friends of yours, and Alan Aragon's a friend of mine, but Schoenfeld and Aragon did a meta-analytic review in 2018. And what they did was they did a systematic review. It was not a meta-analysis, it was a systematic review rather, and it was on the protein dose per meal and protein frequency, and they suggested between 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram per day split around 4 meals with 0.4 to 0.55 grams of protein per kilogram per meal. And in their conclusion, I actually had this written out because I wanted to really quote them properly. And it's based on the
Right.
current evidence, we conclude that to maximize anabolism, one should consume protein at a target intake of 0.4 grams per kilogram per meal across a minimum of 4 meals in order to reach a minimum threshold of 1.6 grams per kilogram per day. Using the upper daily intake of 2.2 kilograms per day reported in the literature spread out over the same 4 meals would necessitate a maximum of 0.55 grams per kilogram per meal. So although people will say that total protein intake is all that matters, and now with this study, they'll say, I can just ingest all of my protein for the day in one single feeding. We do see that when any of the literature that you look at that tests higher daily protein intakes, not protein doses, but total daily protein intakes, and they look at how to spread it out, they do so utilizing multiple feedings. And usually in most of the literature, it's between 3 to 6 meals per day. And we have yet to find any, studies that actually see that if you just consume 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram per day in one meal, that you'll be able to maximize hypertrophy. So I even think like mechanistically, we don't see that, but also like in the real world, how applicable is that? Is someone, say someone's 100 kilograms, are they going to eat 220 grams of protein in one sitting every single day? And yeah, maybe they will,
Right.
but are they going to do it with milk protein? Because now we have to look at what was the actual findings of the study. This is milk protein. Now, there are so many individuals in America today and in all population, I work with people all around the world that have lactose intolerance. So, would you be able to tolerate that? Also, the
Right.
gastric distress that would cause from ingesting more than 100 grams of protein, I'm sure that they had flatulence and gas and bloating because that is a massive dose of a milk protein. And Scott, I think you could back me up on this. It's not only the fact that it slow releases, but it's very extremely filling. And that's why casein protein, I mean, it's like a gunk and it's great to bake with. But if you were ever to take casein protein versus, for someone that's not familiar, if you were ever to take a shaker bottle, you could put whey, and I wouldn't advise doing this, but you could literally take 2 scoops of whey protein, 50 grams of whey protein, and put it in a shaker bottle without any water and pour water into it and mix it up in a few shakes, and you have a shake. You do that with casein, you lost that shaker bottle. That gunk is getting stuck to the bottom of that shaker cup. And so,
Yeah,
we just
it's a
have to think
slug.
about like the ecological validity of a lot of these things. Will you be able to do this on a frequent basis? Maybe once in a while, like you were alluding to, Scott, you have a massively busy day. You're going to be traveling for the rest of the day, so you throw down a massive shake to try to cover your bases. But to do this every day, I don't think this is the direction people should be taking the findings of this study.
Yeah, the thing is, and just I'm going to paint with a broad brush here, but a lot of these protein synthesis studies, this one being an exception, are comparing most of them with whey. Some have compared whey and casein. And this one we've got milk protein. But bodybuilders old school have said, eat as much real food as you possibly can. And I think the idea, look, there is a difference between taking in a meal with protein in terms of what amino acid profile you get from that, and eating protein in each of your meals throughout the day. So protein spacing, matching with the studies that you just covered. For instance, that first day, the Rita study, it was 8 by 10 grams of whey protein
It was all way, yes.
versus all whey, right? This is, I
The
mean,
next
no,
two studies are in mixed meals, though.
right, exactly. And there's a difference there, but the idea, I think, that it's been around for forever is to make sure you get a good amount of protein throughout the day in your meals, and do that with whole food. So don't try to reinvent the wheel and say, you know what, I'm going to just take in two protein feeds, this giant, massive milk protein feeding, and then just have rice the rest of the day with a giant casein bubble gut to deal with. That might be in extreme circumstances. I mean, I've known some people who, like, I knew a guy once who was trying to take 30 semester hours during one term, and all he did was drink a giant supplement. He was in class from literally 8 until 8 every day, and he just had a giant jug with like a protein, like a weight gainer, and that's
Yeah,
what he had
Lord.
to do. So in extreme circumstances, people might have to do something like that if they don't literally don't have time to eat or poop. But for the most part, get your food in, get a sizable amount of protein in those amounts you just mentioned. And the Aragon-Schoenfeld meta-analysis is great, matches with the Morton meta-analysis, or the review matches the Morton meta-analysis. And if you can do it with whole food, do so. You're probably not going to then be able to say, instead of having like my next 80 grams of protein, let's say you're going to do 30 grams of the next three meals, right? 30 to 35 grams next three meals, because that fits with what you need for the day, how big you are. You're just going to say, ah, I'm just going to cook a bunch of rice, and I'm going to have 100 grams of milk protein right off the bat in the morning, and then eat that. That might not be too comfortable. It might work. It might be possible, but there's some potentially some disadvantages for that, practically speaking. And if you're truly being scientific in terms of external validity, so to what extent can we externally, is this information from this study valid to the external world outside of the parameters of the study? Well, it only counts when we're talking about the situation when you're eating nothing else. I don't know. I really don't know what it would be like to take in, 80 grams of casein and then try to eat throughout the day after that. I do know I've had many people, know many people who love Greek yogurt, myself included. But if you try to eat too much Greek yogurt, which has got a lot of casein in it, like your GI just is not happy. It just doesn't
Imagine
work out.
100 grams of that. 100
Yeah, I
grams
mean,
of protein from Greek yogurt in one sitting.
I've done that before. I have some in there that are close to that, and I can do that once in a blue moon, but I couldn't do that on a daily basis. So it may not be sustainable, but it is a very, very, it's very, very interesting what the study has sort of shown us, that it is kind of a protein pacing. It would be really interesting. There is some, help me, there is a study comparing whey boluses versus casein in terms of muscle protein synthesis that I'm recalling, but I can't put my finger on. What would happen, for instance, if you went with four whey boluses of 25 grams over the course of 12 hours in this study? What would we see there? I think we would see, because we've done weight training,
So,
so we're
I'm
not
going
going
to
to
be
have a
honest with
muscle
you,
full
Scott.
effect. Yeah.
Anytime I think, and this is because I come from the supplement industry, whenever I think about a comparison between whey and casein, I always go back to Gorenson et al. 2016, where they did a dose response study, and they looked at 35 grams of different protein sources. And one was a whey protein, one was a micellar casein, and then one was a wheat protein. And whey, the 35 grams of whey protein exceeded, they had a significant increase in muscle protein synthesis compared to both other groups. And so they had, it was like a dose response like this. They saw, I believe it was whey protein was superior to micellar casein and wheat, but micellar casein was superior to wheat. And this is basically based on the leucine threshold, theory. But I don't know if we extrapolated that out over the course of the day, what would be the differences if total protein intake was equated? But you're also talking about dosing this and still using a protein pacing as compared to utilizing what this study did. If we took this exact study design and did 100 grams of a slow digesting milk protein, and that was all we ate for our full protein intake, I don't think we could extrapolate it out the same way.
There's a lot of complicating factors there. So what have we missed? What have we not? What are the other things that people are taking this study to mean that it really doesn't?
Well, you kind of led me into the last topic that I wanted to cover, which is the need to differentiate between the findings we get from protein studies using whey or other dairy protein sources, like essentially powdered protein sources and isolates versus whole food sources. As what a lot of people don't realize, but what we really have to, if we're looking at the evidence, what we have to take into consideration is most of what we know about protein and muscle protein synthesis is based on studies using doses of whey in a fasted state. But this doesn't mean that we can apply all this data to whole food sources. So when we look at like protein, it's, depending on the protein source used, the age of the client, and the amount of the muscle groups that they've trained in a session, the protein intake needed to maximize muscle protein synthesis will vary. And many will say that we only need 20 to 40 grams of protein to maximize muscle protein synthesis, but they fail to mention the fact that those studies that find that using 20 to 40 grams of protein are from whey protein, which is a highly bioavailable complete protein source that has a very high leucine content compared to most whole food protein sources, especially if we're going to plant-based protein sources. And also that 20 gram whey protein dose was found using college-age males who were trained or who were untrained and were sensitized to the anabolic effects of protein from a protein synthetic response perspective. And so this may not apply to the trainee that's in their 50s who's eating a mixed whole food protein sources where they may need a much higher dose of protein to maximize MPS levels. And what's really interesting about this study is that I don't know if you saw this, but just a month prior, another recently released 2023 study came out of Van Loon's lab. So the main
Another one, the
investigator,
Tomlin.
essentially, it wasn't a Trommelin paper, it's Panackers.
Oh,
So
okay.
this study,
Okay.
listen to this, Scott. This study found higher muscle protein synthesis rates after participants ate an animal-based meal as compared to a protein and calorie matched vegan meal. And in this study, they took older
I
men
did
and
see
women
that.
and put them into a crossover design, where they each went through two eating conditions. And on one occasion, they ate a whole food omnivorous meal where beef was the main protein source, and they ate 0.45 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass. So it's right in line with the systematic review by Schoenfeld and Arrigan. And on the other day, they gave those same participants a calorie and protein matched plant-based whole food meal. And so then after each condition, they measured their postprandial amino acid profiles via blood and muscle protein synthesis rates via muscle biopsies for 6 hours. And what's great about this study is they used a crossover design. So each participant acted as their own control, and they use whole food meals rather than protein supplements, which kind of mimic more of what we use and eat in
Sure.
the real world. So in the omnivorous condition, they ate a meal that consisted of lean ground beef, I believe string beans, applesauce, potatoes, and I believe that was it. And it provided that 0.45 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass. Whereas in the vegan condition, they ate a meal consisting of quinoa, chickpeas, soybeans, and soy sauce, which again hit that 0.45 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And so the results found that the animal-based meal increased plasma essential amino acid concentrations more than the plant-based meal over the 6 hour postprandial period. And this meat-based meal also resulted in 45% or 47% higher postprandial muscle protein synthesis rates when compared with the ingestion of a plant-based meal. And I think being aware of research like this is important because not all protein sources are created equal. And often, individuals will take the findings of a study on one protein source and the muscle protein synthesis elevations we see from that specific protein source, and then they'll apply and make it seem like it applies to all protein sources. And this is something many do when looking at the whey isolate literature. And I'm sure that they're going to do the same thing with this milk protein, study. And then that data might not apply to whole intact protein sources from whole foods. And I think the same can be said about, this study on milk protein, because let's think about it logically. There aren't many individuals who are going to be eating or drinking 100 grams of milk protein in one sitting. Yet a lot of people are going to
No.
take this to mean, hey, I'm going to utilize this with whey. And it's not going to increase, oxidation rates, or it's going to maximize. Although, if we think about it logically, whey has much quicker protein kinetics. So it most likely wouldn't, even with that large of a dose, elevate muscle protein synthesis rates for 6 hours due to just the time that it takes to peak. Like, we took a 100 gram bolus of whey. I don't know if it would keep MPS. It would probably peak higher, but I don't think it would elevate MPS levels for 12 hours just due to the digestion and assimilation aspect of it.
No, it wouldn't. Yeah, that's basically what you can kind of take from the Boree study from like 97, where in terms of net protein balance, it was higher with the casein. It beat the whey, and the whey is in and out in 4, 5, 6 hours. Whereas the casein, I think it was a 7 hour actually window, something like that for that study. That recent Tromlin study that I mentioned, where they compared direct comparison of whey versus casein, interestingly enough, the protein, the average over the 7 hour period, the protein synthetic rates were not significantly different between those two. And they both of them were at least mathematically, numerically higher than what they have for 100 grams here of casein over 12 hours, which seemed like it was pretty steady. Different set of subjects, endurance training preceding the protein intake. Again, the interesting thing here is that you have to realize this is sort of proof of concept type of science where we're trying to break apart the mechanisms, see what's going on in a very microscopic fashion, not in something that's trying to mimic what an athlete would try to apply on a meal by meal basis. Like no one's obviously going to start just eating milk protein and no other protein sources and eating nothing else. That'd be ridiculous. But the thing that I think that makes this study so also worth mentioning is that the is well, a couple things just to kind of wrap stuff up is that they found no increase in protein breakdown or oxidation after this larger dose. It makes sense that you're getting a slower release, that maybe you're not exceeding whatever the threshold would be where the protein has nowhere to go, right? And that's something you see with another protein source, but that they also suggest that there's low limit in magnitude and duration in their title. That is very difficult for me to wrap my head around in terms of how they can come to their conclusion based on their data, purely from a scientific perspective. It just doesn't quite, it doesn't resonate with me. Maybe I'm just not sharp enough to grasp it, but I don't see how they can possibly say that from a scientific perspective. So it makes that to some degree for people who are trying to figure out, like, what can I glean from this study in terms of day-to-day application? It gets perfect for. It's perfect social media fodder, really, to be put out there and like, oh my gosh, everything we know about protein is wrong,
It's
right?
disproven.
It's just been disproven. And that you've probably heard me talk about, you're really not proving anything in science. Proofs happen in mathematics. You know, this is just evidence in one direction, but it's never a proof because it could always be, there could always be information that shows something to the contrary. So, yeah, this is an interesting one. This I think hopefully this is going to create some follow-up. I imagine it will. Maybe from Wolf's lab. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what those guys do. That you know, you don't want to see anyone. I don't know. Those guys are probably totally cool with one another. I have no idea. I bet they are, right? They see each other all the
I mean,
conferences.
we have to give credit where it's due. And I know both you and I have the utmost respect for these researchers. Tromlin, who's out of Luke Van Loon's lab, Luke Van Loon is one of the most prominent protein researchers in the world. I mean, behind someone like Stu Phillips, which is arguably the most cited protein researcher in the world, there are very few that are going to compare in terms of a lab analysis perspective. And so, same thing with Bob Wolf, who is down in Texas. These are guys that are at the top of their field. They are the Mount Rushmore of protein metabolism and stuff. And I think that also we have to take it in consideration. The reason I really wanted to have you on this podcast and us to be able to break this down is because I understand that it's not always the researchers themselves. I think oftentimes what ends up happening, and I've had researchers on the podcast, I've spoken off air with researchers and had, private conversations. And a lot of times it could be a very I don't want to say unrewarding field, but it's something that a lot of people, they don't get the gratitude that they deserve. And so
Oh,
a lot of times
yep.
if we look at the average amount of people amount of times that someone opens up a study and actually reads it, it's about six people. If you actually look at the statistics on the actual times that someone actually reads a published study. So they go through all this work. So utilizing catchy headlines and titles that a lot of people don't read, and we both know this, Scott. They don't read past the title or the abstract. So they don't really get into the findings. But what ends up happening is it's not just on the researchers. Yes, they should have the knowledge to know not to do that, but they also are trying to get, people to cite their work as well as to look at their work because they put so many hours. Think about all the time that went into this. However, the real issue is those that don't have a science background and don't have any nutrition nor scientific literacy and that take and run with these abstracts. And then they go on social media and they have a large influence. So these are the influencers and those that are content creators that haven't read the study, but they put things out into the ether, which are impact impressionable individuals. And really, my goal with this podcast has always been to provide clarity on complex topics, but also to bridge the gap between information and research and practical application. So when I see people coming to, and I have clients asking me, hey, does this disprove the fact that we should be eating protein multiple times a day? Or I can eat all my protein in one meal, or maybe I can intermittent fast and just do a 200 gram bolus of protein. And it's like, listen, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But also, you're taking information from individuals that aren't educated enough to really break these things down, and they're misinforming you. Whereas we have yet to hear any of the researchers, like if you actually look at the posts from the re like those in the research group, they didn't make any egregious claims besides the title. So I will give them slack for that. But it's not like they've said that this is you only need to eat protein one time per day, like or any of those things. So I really wanted to just clear the air on this study because I know that there was a lot of misextrapolations. And oftentimes people are putting things out there to get clicks. So if there's a topic that is very popular, like protein is, and there's a controversial study, they'll glamorize it to the utmost extent. The same thing happened with the deload study where people were saying deloads don't work and you should never deload again. And it's like, that's not what the study found. It showed pretty equivalent outcomes between, and it wasn't even a deloaded study. It was a detraining study. They took a week off. It's like, you're going to get equivalent outcomes in terms of hypertrophy, whether you take a week off or not. But your strength might be impacted a little bit. And there were some fatigue mechanisms that showed that, or motivation mechanisms, which showed that they're a little less motivated when they took a proactive deload where they were forced to deload even when their biofeedback said that they didn't need it. So it's like we have to really look and be intellectually honest. And that's something, Scott, I have the utmost respect for you from an intellectual honesty perspective because you are always unbiased, you're upfront, and then you're also critical, but you're also like you're critical in the sense that you'll dive into a study and pick it apart, but you're also very gracious in terms that you give credit where it's due. And I think that being able to take a very unbiased perspective at a lot of these topics really provides people with better education, better critical thinking skills. That's one of the biggest things impacts that you've had on me, being a more of a critical thinker, which I truly appreciate. And beyond that, it's like we don't have a bias. Like it's not like we're funded by Big Protein. We're like, or I'm funded by Whey Protein over here, where I don't want you to get milk protein. So I don't want any, clout to go to like milk protein concentrates anymore.
No
This
milk
not the
protein.
thing. I want to make sure, and I know you have the same intention. I just want people to not be misled or to buy into things that they think is evidence-based or the newest thing and they're running with it. And it's like, we don't have enough data to substantiate that. And we can't take one, like I mentioned in the beginning of the intro of this podcast, we can't take one new study and throw the baby out with the bathwater and the rest of the very substantiated, well done evidence that we have multifold of. Like we have so many studies reinforcing, doses above 20 grams to maximally stimulate protein synthesis. We have the muscle full effect. So that was 48 grams of protein. We see the protein kinetics in that, whey protein peaked at 90 minutes and they were came back down to baseline in 3 hours. And infusing more amino acids did not stimulate muscle protein synthesis any further. Like there's so much great research that often when it's a date that's before 2023 or 2024 at this point, it's like it gets forgotten. And I never want that to be the case because you and I have dug into many studies throughout the calls that you and I have done privately. And we're going back to the early 2000s or to the 90s. And it's like this stuff is still applicable today. They did incredible research then, and this served as forming the foundation to what we've built on from there. And it's good to look back and look at where the foundation has started, where we've come from there, and then really build upon a body of evidence rather than just taking one study and running with it.
And so maybe to close this out, there's some things this study tells us that no one's gone to 100 grams of protein before. This is a dose that's exceeded. And they did demonstrate if we just, and who knows, quantitative, maybe there's some things that don't match up with other ideas in terms of what happens to reversing protein breakdown with higher protein doses or whatever, or mixed meals. But this does show that we do have, if we're looking at the toolbox that bodybuilders or fitness enthusiasts would have, that we do have maybe not 100 grams, but we do have maybe 50 grams of milk protein or higher doses of milk protein as something that will maintain or at least give us a buoy in terms of muscle protein synthesis over a prolonged period of time, when we may have a bunch of business meetings we have to take, we have to get on a flight, we don't want to eat the plane food or what have you. We've got some information that's sort of expanding our horizon. And like we've mentioned here, there's some things that are kind of contradictory, they don't always match. The protein synthetic numbers seem to be different. Not every study matches up perfectly with another, but this gives us this sort of, now we know a little bit, we've sort of expanded our circle of knowledge to the 100 gram range over 12 hours. So 100 grams, never gone that high, and they went 12 hours. I don't think everyone's ever gone that way with this methodology at least. So this is actually really pretty cool that they did this. And they kept it clean. They didn't throw it, they weren't fed, so you don't have to worry about that. That's maybe not so practical, but we know now, like, no one's going to say, well, you got to have food to maintain this protein synthesis. In this case, what they're saying is that you didn't, at least in these individuals, the caveats being that they were untrained, they're very sensitive to the training stimulus and everything else. We didn't see the muscle protein breakdown. That's a bit odd, but at least we know that, heck, some milk protein would be better than nothing if you're just
Absolutely.
trying to avoid it, which sometimes you probably, like, this is a little bit off the topic, but sometimes people get sort of so orthorexic, so to speak, with their eating that they just want, they want to eat exactly what's on their plan and they want anything else. And it's like, if you can't get your food and you have some milk protein that you stuffed in your glove box that hasn't been sitting in the heat for 4 years, it probably would be a better choice
100%.
than having nothing, for sure. So this is kind of, now this opens, like, they've actually sort of, this is in a way, it's kind of a challenge to the research. Like, okay, let's see what you got. We went 12 hours. They did more measurements than I think I've ever seen in a protein synthesis study. They really, like, they went to town. I'm not sure, it was Tromlin. So he's, this seems like the type of thing that often would happen with the PhD student, has to sort of earn his way through. And like, he's got to do, like, I've seen this, like, back in the day when I was a student, is that, they would make a student do like study after study after study. He's published like five things before he could get his PhD,
Now, he's a
just so he's got,
well-established researcher, though.
what's that?
He's a well-established researcher.
That's what I'm
Yeah,
saying,
he's
that he's a
postdoc.
well-established researcher. So this isn't a PhD student that they, said, we want you to know how to do everything. Obviously, there are several names on this, but like, they went deep into it. And the thing that was really, really, we haven't really touched on the molecular signaling, is that nothing changed. Like, the only thing I think where there was a time by condition interaction was mRNA for myostatin. And it was just like a weird blip downward if with the 25 gram at 240 minutes. It was like nothing. It's what, when you make 100 measurements, you'd expect, there to be some interactions just by chance, right? So there was literally nothing that was turned on. The protein didn't have an impact on molecular signaling or the gene expression, and neither did the training itself. Everything was just like, it was a
Yeah,
void. And you,
Scott,
can
I'm
you
going to be
imagine
honest with you.
having done that? Like, all those measurements and you don't get anything to talk about? That would be like, that shows some, actually some academic integrity in my mind, that they published this and there's nothing. You can look at the data, like, the data show what seems like, visually, I'm no expert here, normal variability. They put the medians and the means and the confidence intervals. Like, they went to town on this and they got nothing out of it. So it was really fascinating. They didn't really address that, but a massive amount of information. So it's huge kudos to the effort that went into this. Like, this was a pretty badass effort. It's kind of like, it's the guy who, who's the bodybuilder, like, break it down to what some of the listeners can understand, who just has horrible genetics, right? And he transforms himself relative to his possibility and he gets seventh place. But what he did is heads and shoulders above what anyone else did to get to stage in that condition. It's like, these guys went to town and they got some cool findings, but like, in terms of the gene expression and the signaling, it's like, oh, it would have been cool to see something, right? But there was nothing there. So the study's got some pretty cool, pretty interesting findings, and no finding is a finding. No significance does say something. And the last thing I'll say on that, that's important in terms of applicability, is that this, one of the kind of quizzical findings of the study, is that protein synthesis was elevated to this massive extent, 13 grams in 12 hours, new myofibrillar protein, which would give you if you did that, we say like 96 to 100 pounds of protein in the course of a year, like that's massive rate of muscle growth if we try to extrapolate that out. But that was accompanied by no changes in any of the signaling proteins or the gene expression, nada. So those things are correlated. Those transcription factors and signaling molecules all correlated with muscle growth. That's why they get measured, and they're correlated. They're involved with mTOR doing its job as well. Those didn't change. So that's another thing that says, you know, this is kind of cool. It's kind of like the car got painted. It looks beautiful. Let's look at all the protein synthesis, but the engines, there's no oil in there, and there's no gas. It's not going to go very far. It looks pretty. Looks like it's ready to roll, but it's not really roadworthy. You got to be turning those things on. That probably would have required energy. It would have been interesting if they added, you know, had another condition, 100 grams of protein with 200 grams of carbs. It might have turned on a bunch of those signaling molecules. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. No, not to get too, I don't want to get down into this rabbit hole, but I did find it very interesting that mTOR wasn't stimulated, especially the fact that mTOR is a complex that's stimulated by multiple things. Resistance training, first and foremost, different hormones. So insulin increasing from the milk protein in and of itself should activate mTOR. Muscle protein in and of itself should activate mTOR. So the fact that we didn't see that, that's why I think it's good to be cautionary with acute findings and trying to extrapolate to longitudinal outcomes, which is why we see in many of
Absolutely.
Wotard, you references, there's a review, I believe it's by Wotard, from a few years ago, where essentially it's an entire review on how muscle protein synthesis, especially in the acute findings, does not correlate with muscle growth. And it's about more than just mechanisms. So we have to think of mechanisms, molecules, but then also the man and really doing the hard work and really seeing if it's compounding interest and actually leading to something. But as always, Scott, I truly appreciate you being on the show. You and I always have an incredible conversation, and I'm glad that you and I do this on a weekly basis, but I really appreciate you allowing me to record this and release it to the audience for their benefit as well. Please let the audience know. I'm going to link everything below, but please let them know where they can find you. This is without a shadow of a doubt, and I know he's going to hate me for saying this, but Scott, just bear me out. This is the smartest man in bodybuilding, without a shadow of a doubt. This is someone that I look to as a mentor, as someone that is immensely influential in my own ability to assimilate knowledge and then also be a critical thinker, and someone I bounce things off of all the time. So Scott, thank you so much for being here with me first and foremost. I always appreciate you, but also for, sharing your knowledge with our audience. So please let them know where they could find you, whether that be social media, your website, your books. Don't forget any of
You know, I'm horrible at that, the
them.
self-aggrandizing advertising. I can't do it. I'm terrible at it. I
I'm
need to
about to
hire
do it for you.
somebody, but I'm not even like smart enough to hire someone to do it, 'cause that would be like, you know, now investing in myself, which, you know, I'm not terribly good at either when it comes to some things. I'd like to give more than I'd like to receive. But first of all, thanks for that. I appreciate the kind words, brother. I'm on Instagram. You can find me there. You can find me. I've got a web page that it's pretty obvious I did it myself. I had a big brain dump that I finished up in 2018. That was my Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book, which is one of my sort of, it's really, really gratifying because I hear back from people like almost on a daily basis, several times a week, telling me, you know, they read my book, they competed, they got on stage, did it all themselves, and my book was their guide. And it's like, oh, that's so cool to have seen someone actualize that way, and that know that I played a hand in that. And they might not have felt like they could do that. So I'm kind of the anti-coach in that I believe you can get a lot more out of doing like you and I do. We have chats, and taking the ball and running with it as much as you possibly can on your own, and then maybe coming to someone for some consultations, but only when you really push yourself. So that's why I wrote that book, and that's what I'm kind of all about. I'm not big into the standard coaching anymore, where you do check-ins and kind of tell the soldiers what to do. I'm more about trying to teach the soldiers to take their own road and learn their own path. So that's what I try to do with podcasts like this, my own podcast, and and the book Fortitude Training was my training regime I came up with like a decade ago now, right? It's kind of cool. There's some of the theory and the background that I have in there definitely needs to be revised. Just like mechanisms of muscle growth and those sorts of things. But it's really kind of cool to see, because that was a piece together based on what I'd learned. I've been training since I was 11. So I've been training for over 40 years now, right? What made sense, and then what the literature sort of suggested. And I hear people talking about stretch-mediated hypertrophy and deloads and yada yada yada, all the various things. And it's like, ah, I'm so happy I built it into fortitude training. You can actually do that because I saw there was, potential for that. And if you don't want to, you don't have to do those things, but the things you do, you can. So I've got this program that's built on the person, just like with the book, with the person being the one who takes the reins. I got an inquiry the other day from someone. He's said, "Hey, I've heard about your book. I want to do fortitude training. And I was wondering if you could help me choose the exercises." And I told him, I said, "Honestly, it would be ideal that you're to the point where you can pick your own exercises." And that's the strength of the program, is that you pick the exercises that work for you. Now, if you buy the book, I have a discussion board. I'll advertise this. Anyone who buys the book, they have free access to a discussion board. I answer questions for free for anyone who's willing to pay. Well, I have a dime a day membership. That's just to keep the bots out. But $20 and you have access to me for my life, at least, as long as I'm on there. And I do that for people to try to help them figure out how to do it themselves. So even the training program is about recognizing that eventually you should get to the point where you know yourself better than anyone else, right? And some coach saying, "Yeah, you need to do exercise X, Y, and Z." If that runs against your gut instinct, then your gut instinct probably is right, as if you've been at it for a while. So I'm all about self-development, I guess. As contradictory as that may seem in the context of bodybuilding, really, I think it's one of the best ways that that can happen, because it's an intellectual challenge, it's a physical challenge. It can become quite a psychological challenge, maybe even a spiritual challenge. It challenges you to organize yourself. There's so many things that I've learned from it, so I try to help people to take on that challenge, because I think there's intrinsic rewards that are part of having a good life, and I'm all for people having good lives. So
Yeah.
how about that for an advertisement, man? That was good. I didn't
I'm
even write
proud of you,
that shit
Scott.
down. I just came up with it
It's
off the
taken
top of my
many
head.
years to get this out of you. So I am proud of you. But guys, as always, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Chasing Clarity Podcast. Wish you a great weekend ahead. And Scott, thank you so much. And the rest of the audience, peace.
Absolutely. Adios.